Hi, this is Jeannie Drisco bringing you an episode of The Art and Soul of Healing. We're going to pick up where we left off last time with Dr. Lynn Patrick. Lynn is a naturopathic doctor with over 35 years of experience in environmental medicine, endocrine disruption, metal toxicology, and other associated topics. Let's rejoin Lynn now in this fascinating discussion.
That immediately is a dietary intervention, probably more severe than most clinicians are willing to make.
Yeah, it scares me a little bit with these sick patients.
Yes, and I think Dr. Ray knew how to do that. Mm-hmm. He knew how to do that appropriately, and he would not have done that appropriately in someone who actually needed IV fluids and IV nutrition. Mm-hmm. But the point being that removing that exposure begins to lower body burden, because if it's constantly coming in, for example, if you have someone who is eating a food that they can't tolerate, you know, you're adding to the body burden every single meal that that person has. Mm-hmm. So I think dietary change is really important and effective. And it has to be done judiciously, of course.
Yes.
But I think that, you know, following that basic rule of toxicology, if we've got an emergency situation, in other words, the patient's in an environment that they're clearly not tolerating, you know, there may have to be an intervention, a significant intervention that's done right away. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I can't tell you the number of patients that I've seen who have visible black mold on their bedroom walls or in their bathroom, who have no idea how toxic the Stachybotrys mycotoxins are, who have pulmonary symptoms, who probably have vascular damage. Mm-hmm. And they need to be moved out of that environment right away.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Yeah, the whole issue about mold evaluation, how do you approach that? Do you send, I know sometimes they have these devices where you can put in the home and they collect the air. Do you think those are helpful?
So I think the answer to the question depends on the actual geographical location of the doctor and the patient. If you're fortunate enough to live in an area like Southern California, where there are some of the best biologists and industrial hygienists, building biologists, excuse me, I'll call them by their English name. Biology is a German term. Building biologists and industrial hygienists will come in and do air sampling. And now we actually have a procedure called the EMMA test, E-M-M-A, that actually tests for room air mycotoxin count.
Mm-hmm. We did that and we used that.
So that's a fairly new technology, but that is a good way to look at how lethal, I don't know any other word to use, how dangerous or detrimental the actual mycotoxin count in the room air is. So that can be done without a building biologist and without an industrial hygienist. The laboratory makes that available to the doctor, and then the doctor just gives the collection plates to the patient. They take them home and set them out. I think that having an industrial hygienist or a building biologist do the collecting and the home inspection is much more, it's more expensive, obviously, but it's going to be much more effective at actually looking at potential problems that the patient may not be able to identify just by doing home mold testing. So that's always my first preference. And working here, I'm in southwestern Colorado. We don't have any building biologists, but we do have really good industrial hygienists that can actually look at the moisture content of the structural wood in someone's home, which can be the source of mold and mycotoxins that you wouldn't find necessarily by plating out the mold in the home.
Oh, and that's so interesting. I didn't know that.
So this comes mostly from either a leaky roof or a leaky window contains.
Yes.
Leaky windows. that goes into the structural wood, and then the cellulose in the structural wood actually becomes the source of the mold in the home. And one of my sickest patients that I actually co-managed with Dr. Ray for several years, I'm happy to say that he is now summiting 14,000 foot mountains for fun in Colorado when he couldn't get out of bed for weeks and weeks. That was his problem, is the construction of his home. This is very, very common. Allowed the windowsills to leak, and his structural wood became wet, and he actually had to go through a process of drying out the structural wood in his home with some heaters in the, you know, the basement of his house. But he got better, his home got better, his home recovered, and you know, he's here to talk about it.
Oh, that's great. And then you talked a little bit about measuring organic chemicals in the biologic system with blood, urine, fat biopsies. How about measuring heavy metals?
So metals are the most talked about, let's say, in integrative medicine. And one of the first things that all of us, I'll include myself, learn to look for in sick patients back in the 80s. Mm-hmm. We were taught back then to look in the urine and to then give the patient a chelating agent like EDTA, DMSA, or DMPS, look in the urine again and look at the difference between that baseline urine and the what we call the post-provocative urine, the post-provocation urine. Mm-hmm. And if the level rose a certain amount or any, then we would treat, you know, we would diagnose that. So, you know, 20 years, 30 years have gone by. And we've learned a lot about metals.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
And what we know now is that it's much more difficult than what we originally thought. Mm-hmm. And that we haven't tested, we haven't always used the right tests. So I think that you may remember this. In the year 2012, the American College of Medical Toxicology.
Yes, I do.
And at that conference, the American College of Medical Toxicology and all of the state medical boards who were also present.
I was at that conference.
You were at the conference?
Yes.
Good grief.
Someone invited me. They thought that I, and then they didn't realize that I have this inside information.
Oh,
but anyway, go ahead.
Well, you're really the right person to talk about this. But so please feel free to comment. But as a result of that conference, the basically the American College of Medical Toxicology published several articles in the Journal of Toxicology saying, you know, that this should be illegal. I don't know that they use that word, but it should not, it's not standard of care for toxicology to do that. And that any physician who uses that methodology for diagnosing metal toxicity should be called up in front of their state medical board.
Yes.
So at that time, I remember being at an ACAM conference, and you and I were in ACAM together, and I remember meeting with several of the doctors and our legal team, and the legal team saying, well, we have to change how we educate our doctors. And so from that moment on, we started teaching metal toxicology very differently, more in line, I have to say, with the actual toxicological literature, not a bad thing. That doesn't mean that provocation isn't a just and usable method of diagnosing metal toxicity. But we learned, and I have learned as a result of teaching for ACAM in the chelation training program and the metal toxicology program, that it is not always either necessary or appropriate to do provocation testing to diagnose metal toxicity. And arsenic is probably the best example of that. Right. As well that lead toxicity is most appropriately tested for in the blood and not in the urine, and that it's the standard of care. And actually, we know now that all the research has been published looking at the correlation or the relationship of whole blood lead to risk for cardiovascular disease, that's really a much more useful tool in understanding patients' risks for mortality from stroke and heart attack by looking at a whole blood lead. Mm-hmm. So it's metal. dependent, meaning when the patient comes in, they're going to present a certain kind of combination of signs and symptoms. And if you are familiar with metal, the different metal toxicity pictures, you'll be able to say, oh, this person has peripheral neuropathy, they're anemic, they have some inflammatory bowel disease symptoms, they have some brain fog, and they work as a carpenter sawing up outdoor wood. Mm-hmm. They are most at risk for arsenic toxicity.
Absolutely.
Classic presentation of arsenic toxicity. I'm going to look in their urine for arsenic, but I'm not going to use a provoking agent. I'm just going to say, hey, patient Sam, here, go pee in a cup, and then let's send it into the lab. And if it's high enough, I'm going to need you to collect your urine for 24 hours so we can have something we can really use as the kind of gold standard diagnosis for arsenic toxicity. So that's just one example that comes mm-hmm. to mind about how important it is for doctors to know metal toxicity. And this is not rare. I cannot tell you, you know, I had a patient who was a nurse who worked in a legal firm that did environmental toxicology cases. That's how she knew to come to me.
Oh, interesting.
She had helped her husband build an outdoor deck. And they've taken arsenic out of preserved wood.
Yes.
But this was a while ago. They still used arsenic in preserving wood. Mm-hmm. And they had sawed it up, and she had used her bare hands. She didn't wear gloves. And the wood was wet. And so she actually had arsenic toxicity as a result of dermal exposure and inhalation exposure to preserved wood. But she'd gone to her neurologist. And her neurologist had done a blood arsenic level that was within
worthless. Yeah.
And her neurologist had said to her, you know, you're making this up.
Yeah.
But she had stocking glove peripheral neuropathy mm-hmm. that would not go away. And because some of the damage was inflicted historically when she was exposed to the arsenic, because it's quite a serious oxidant. You know, there's a lot of oxidative damage that happens, especially to the nervous system. And we had to work to help her repair that. But she also had arsenic in her water. Her drinking water.
Yes, that's
no neurologist never even asked about that.
Right.
Asked her drinking water. So right. I think we have so many areas in which just small little questions and interventions mm-hmm. will be life-saving for mm-hmm. patients.
What about EMFs?
So there's a story behind that. In 2018, Bill, you know, Dr. Ray had polio, and his polio had come back. And the reason that is important in explaining my relationship to EMFs is that he rolled up to me at a conference. And, you know, Dr. Ray really never talked to me. I was never really important enough to talk to, you know, in his world. He had much more important things to do, which he did. He was flying back and forth to the European Union to talk to the parliament about EMFs. But he said, I need to put on a conference on EMFs and I want your help. This was at EHS 2017 or 18. And so we embarked on putting together a global conference in the United States together. And then sadly, Dr. Ray passed in 2018. So I continued with the help of very dedicated activists in this area to put on a global conference on EMFs in California in 2019. And it was there that I met a brilliant oncologist, Dr. Dominique Bellepomme from Paris, who has probably published more than anyone on what we call electrosensitivity. So patients who are chemically sensitive, you know, these would be your, you know, environmentally exposed patients who were also electrosensitive. And what Dr. Bellepomme did is brain scans, a ton of blood work, and he was actually able to identify the fingerprint in these patients that is now used as a diagnostic fingerprint. And I just did a podcast on this for the AMEI review about 2 or 3 months ago.
Okay.
Palm's published research. He's published in 2020, so he just continues to publish on this patient cohort. But at that conference, I was really fortunate to hear these brilliant minds who spent their careers literally not only learning about EMFs, but researching EMF exposure. And what I realize is that, you know, people have concerns about 5G, and I think it is right to have concerns about 5G because it's microwave radiation. But 2, 3, and 4G can be just as damaging, given the susceptibility of the person who's being exposed to them and the amount of exposure that they have. Mm-hmm. And so what we're learning about EMFs and EMF-induced disease, you know, you've got the obvious glioblastoma, you know, as a result of holding a cell phone to your head.
Right.
But there's much more pervasive systemic damage that occurs. You know, what Dr. Ray said to me and Dr. McCarter, who has kind of taken over EHC Dallas for him, Stephanie McCarter, is he said, you know, EMFs are, you know, your generation. He was in his 70s, my generation, in his 80s, excuse me. He said it's our generation's cigarette smoke.
Oh, interesting.
I think that analogy is fitting for a number of reasons, right? One is the invisibility of it. Not that cigarette smoke's invisible, but the damage for a long time was, you know, invisible. But the other reason is, and this is a fascinating concept, people, well-intentioned or not, are selling all kinds of remediation devices, like, you know, little dots you can stick on your computer or your cell phone to eliminate the effect of EMFs. And I think that this is dangerous because it gives us a false sense of security that the exposures that we still have, they don't take away the exposure, somehow become even more invisible. Meaning we think about them less, we're not aware of them. So I think that as we continue, because the other thing Dr. Ray said is that because of the effect on electromagnetic radiation, on cell membrane stability, that pharmaceutical interventions will become less and less effective. And so even for things like neuropathic pain, headaches, et cetera, that pain medications will become less and less effective because we don't have the same membrane stability. You know, the cell membrane is very crucial to the entrance or exit of all the really important hormones and molecules that make the cell work or the mitochondria work. And with this cell membrane instability, which Dr. Bell-Palm talks about a lot, actually, in his research, we are becoming more and more at risk for toxicity from other external toxicants. So, for example, it appears from Dr. Bell-Palm's research that, and Dr. McCarter and Dr. Ray's clinical experience, that those folks who have metals, and I'm talking about dental implant titanium, as well as mercury amalgam fillings, in their bodies are more susceptible to not only the effect of those metals in their body systemically as hypersensitivity reactions, but they're more susceptible to the effect of EMFs and you know, radio frequency radiation. So I think that perfect storm, so to speak, is gathering. I think it's already hit right now, actually. And that it will become difficult, if not impossible, to treat environmentally exposed patients without doing some kind of remediation for their exposure to EMFs. And what I mean by that is, you know, their home, their bedroom.
I have a question. So we used a device you could plug into the outlet. Yes. Do you think that's helpful?
I'll give you an example of where I think it is helpful and where it's not helpful. So these devices, I have them in my outlets.
I use them in my home as well. That's why I'm asking.
So they are a way to minimize dirty electricity that's running through the wiring in the home.
Right.
In most situations, they can minimize that. And that's a form of radio frequency radiation that's actually coming through the wiring in the house, right? The wiring that's not clad in metal. For most of us, that's almost all the wiring in
right,
the home.
Right.
However, if, as in my situation, you have solar panels on your roof and a smart meter on
I've got
your
both
building,
of those too.
We can talk. A smart meter on your home, the increase in dirty electricity. Smart meters really increase the dirty electricity in a home. And unfortunately, solar panels, unless they're really wired in a specific way, depending on where the inverters are, can do the same thing. In that case, unfortunately, and I know this in my own situation because I've looked using an oscilloscope and a meter that measures the oscillating electricity and the dirty electricity, that the Stetzer meters are not enough. Mm. So fortunately, there is a technology that's available that will treat or will minimize, meaning takes it down to where it's not even measurable, the dirty electricity in a home. So there are all kinds of interventions. And I'm happy to say that the EMF conference that took place, last year and 2019 now, is going to be given again in January online.
Oh, that's great. I'll listen to that.
Yeah. I'll give you the link to that, the EMF Medical Conference, put together by a brilliant team of doctors. And I'm very excited. It's happening soon. It's happening at the end of this month. It's a 4-day online conference. Dr. McCarter is going to be presenting. You know, she's the internist that's, along with Dr. Beth Seymour, taken over Environmental Health Center Dallas.
Oh, so, I didn't know that.
Yeah. So EHCD continues even better than before. They moved into a new facility. And they diagnose and treat EMF exposure related problems. You know, Dr. Ray, genius, he had an actual little room that you could go into that was shielded from EMFs. And in this little room, he would put into the air micromolecular amounts of pesticides or volatile organic compounds to, and then of course, you know, the patient was hooked up, to measure pulse rate, blood pressure, et cetera. Respiration rate. And he would actually in real time be able to see how the patient reacted. Mm-hmm. And this room was also used to test EMF exposure.
Yeah. So, was that a copper room?
Yeah.
Yes. When I trained with Hugh Reardon, he had a copper wire room as well. So I got familiar with that there.
Great.
Yeah.
Great. So yes, this was a little Faraday cage. So
yes.
EMF safe. But I will tell you, Jeannie, that right now there are probably about 10 different doctors in conversation about the necessity for having an EMF shielded facility in which mm-hmm. to treat patients.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it makes sense to me.
And they are actually planning to do that. And it's not that hard. You just put the copper wire on all four walls, ceiling, and floor of a room, and you've got an EMF shielded room.
Well, we're coming up on an hour and there's so many more things I want to talk about. Is there a possibility I could schedule with you another time?
Sure.
Oh, that'd be awesome.
Fun.
Yeah, it's, I tell you, I got interested in this in the late 2000s because Kenny Bach and I set up a detoxification meeting for Institute for Functional Medicine.
Uh-huh.
So that's where I really started learning and working and understanding detoxification and environmental medicine. I stepped back from that because it was just too much to teach there and at KU and run the clinic, yeah. But they're still running. They've changed it to environmental health or environmental medicine course now, but.
Advanced practice module.
Yes.
Yes, yes.
Uh-huh. Yes.
We can talk about that later as well.
Well, I want to thank you. And I will set up a time that you can come back because this is just, it's so delicious for me. I can't tell you. But your published papers on metal toxicology are terrific. And I have used them as references in my writing. So thank you for that.
Good. You're so welcome. The ones in AltMed Review, or is that what you're talking about?
Yes, your papers, your series of papers.
Yeah, well, you know, now that I'm part of the IMCJ journal, I'm hoping to write some more.
Oh, it's wonderful. So we'll sign off now, and then I will have you back. And I want to thank you for your brilliance.
Oh, you're so welcome. I'm honored. And it's fun for me. So I appreciate it as well. You're a wonderful soul, and I enjoy talking with you too.
Well, thank you. Thank you, Dr. Lynn Patrick. This was such a fascinating discussion that I'm going to have Dr. Patrick come back and tell us about her approach to the toxic patient and what can be done to restore health and vitality. Until next time, thank you from the art and soul of healing.